Welcome to the Mojo Podcast. It's wonderful to have you here, wherever you are and whatever you're doing. I love getting messages from people listening to the podcast whilst walking the dog, going out for a run, just chilling in the garden. Some even whilst taking on significant challenges, like walking around the coastline of the island of Ibiza, where I live, and I know a bunch of people have just completed this 200-kilometre endeavour. And on endeavours and taking on challenges and conquering them, I was blown away by the response to my guest last time, the effervescent Lara Millward. Really recommend you checking out that episode. But today, get ready for numerous nautical metaphors from me as we plot a course and set sail with the inspiring Captain Donald Lawson, sailor, adventurer, and role model.
Representation inspires others to follow the path. And so one of my jobs is make sure that I'm out there, I'm speaking about it, I'm teaching, I'm helping others so that some kid will see me and say, I want to outdo everything that Captain Lawson did.
I've called this episode Representation is Inspiration based on this quote. And this is a big part of why Donald does what he does and what drives him every day. We know what the Williams sisters have done for tennis, what Tiger Woods has done for minorities taking up golf, and what Lewis Hamilton continues to do every day for motor racing and sport in general. Well, Donald intends that his incredible exploits and future plans, and they are big, will draw more people of colour towards the sport of sailing. And on those plans, Captain Donald is planning to break the American record for a solo circumnavigation of the Earth by boat. And in 2024, he's aiming to be the first African-American to take on the epic and perilous Vendée Globe yacht race, with a likelihood of nearly 3 months alone at sea. He shares his vision for this quest and just where it all came from, which is a young boy growing up in Baltimore, born into a basketball-crazy family, may not have been so obvious. But we talk about the single moment in time that planted the seed of a dream in his head, aged just 9, when a short voyage changed the course of his life. Donald also shares how the reaction to his involvement in sailing wasn't always positive. People putting his success down to the quality of his boat versus the skill of his sailing, and other ingrained prejudices. But crucially, there were allies on hand to help him find his way into sailing then and now to help him take on these mammoth adventures he's got planned. To paraphrase Barack Obama, this is a case of yes, you can. I think you'll love this episode and you're going to hear just what joy and passion sound like in Donald's voice from the off. Remember to subscribe, rate and review the episode. As just as Donald wants more American kids to fall in love with sailing, I'd love more people to enjoy and find inspiration in this podcast. Now, over to my Mojo conversation with Captain Donald Lawson. So, welcome back to the Mojo podcast, and I'm delighted to be joined today by Captain Donald Lawson, and we literally go, I love to say this, over the pond to the US, USA. And Donald, how are you doing today? Lovely to see you.
Hey, Richard. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, my friend.
And so you're currently in Ohio, although home is Baltimore. Is that right?
That's correct. My wife and I have a nice cabin out here in the mountains that we kind of go to. But Baltimore is home. I kind of miss it. I haven't been there a little while because of COVID and the weather. But we're scheduled to go back in April. So
great.
Looking forward to seeing my mom and dad.
Ah, wonderful. Yes. Well, we all are looking forward to seeing our parents who we've been separated from. And we're going to probably get you a bit nostalgic. We're going to talk about Baltimore because that's where this all started for you. So we're going to talk about that in a minute. But I always start with this question, Donald, and it's to get a gauge on your mojo right now. So out of 10, what would you say your mojo's at?
I would say my mojo always hovers around about 9.5. And that 0.5, to get to the 0.5, it generally requires a good drink, an ocean, the beach, either a sunset or a sunrise. Because for me, I get to be one with nature, one with the ocean, and then the drink kind of smells me out a little bit.
I got it. So I love that. You're giving me also your score, but also the components of what makes your mojo, gets your mojo a bit higher. So this this closeness to nature, actually being within nature on the ocean. Yes. And a little drink just to relax.
It's a natural spirit generally, but yes, I like to have a complete ecosystem of you know, calmness around me. So Mojo for me really is about, you know, what life energy you have, what gets you going, what makes you complete. And so one thing I like about your system and your show is that, you know, the positive energy that comes out of it, you hear people talk about, you know, the things that make the best out of them. And for me, ocean is my, you know, sanctuary, if you will.
Love it. Yeah. And that sense of knowing what you need more of, I guess, when your mojo is maybe a little bit down, and I say yours sounds like it's always on as a pretty good level, but you know what to do if it starts to drift down a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we're all human. So, you know, 9.5 is where I hover. I may go down to 7.5 depending on the climate, weather, I guess, or the stuff going on in the world. But generally, you have to have some way to recharge your mojo, because that's your life energy. That's what you convey to the earth, to the people around you, your children. And if you don't have your ways of getting it back together, it's just not the same. So yeah, my mojo is all based on, you know, serenity and peace of mind. And that's why we have this cabin up here. I can come up here and focus on my work and deal with, you know, the little geese and ducks running around back there and the deer, and feel like I'm one with nature, and then get back to society.
Yeah. So you're here. You are. You're in kind of, you know, my geography of the U.S. is pretty basic, but I'm guessing in the middle of the country.
Yeah, north Midwest.
North Midwest. So you're kind of away from the oceans at the moment.
Yes.
But the oceans are your kind of, I guess, your natural habitat. These are the places where, and a lot of what we're going to talk about today has happened and will happen for you, right? Going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. The ocean is home. I grew up in Baltimore, which is on the Chesapeake Bay on the Atlantic seaboard, right near DC. The environment is, everything's water-based, the foods, the seafood, the culture. And so for me, when I'm not near the ocean for long periods of time, I feel it. You know, my heart rate may go up a little bit more. I feel a little more stress. And so being out here, what this does for me, I get to separate it. And so it's one of those things where if you're around things too much, you don't appreciate them as much. And so for me, just to get away, even if it's just for a month, I start craving it again, the ocean again. And then I go back to the ocean. I get like really, really excited. I get really dedicated and tend to do really well.
I love that. Okay. So it's almost a bit of balance. It's like too much of a great thing almost brings the appreciation down. So you separate yourself, take yourself away, and then go back there, and you're re-engaged, you're re-energized by the sounds of it.
Yes.
Again.
Absolutely.
Yeah, great.
Absolutely.
Wonderful. And I wanted to talk about kind of how you got started with sailing, with everything you do in and around the sea, because, you know, it sounds like from we've spoken before, but from your upbringing, maybe the expectation, yours, your family, of actually getting involved in activity on the sea was maybe not the first thing that was on people's mind. Tell me a bit about that and sort of growing up in Baltimore.
Yeah, absolutely. You hit it right on the head. Perfect. I don't come from a sailing family. And I'm sure people who are listening, just so they know, I am an African American. So in my culture, not a lot of folks go on the water, go on boats. And so what transpired for me at a young age was my mother was a camp counselor. And the trip was to go sailing on a schooner in Baltimore's Harbor. And I got to go for the first time at 9 years old. And during that experience, I instantly fell in love with it because I got to be free as a 9-year-old. And you know, we're all kind of old now, but just think back when you're 9 and you can barely ride a bicycle. Maybe you can skateboard. Maybe you can go to your friend's house until the streetlights come on, then you have to come back home. But at 9 years old, a captain of the boat let me steer this 100-foot sailboat and told me, hey, you know, you can sail this boat around the world. And that sense of freedom and opportunity is what set me off. And I just started pursuing boats nonstop because I always wanted to go back to that sense of freedom and that peace of mind that I got as a 9-year-old. And so we look at Baltimore, the harbor, Chesapeake Bay as a whole, there's so many opportunities to sail there. I mean, Chesapeake Bay is so massive. I think you can almost fit like a couple states inside of it. And so there's so many places you can go and visit. So much of my childhood, starting off until I was like 16, was just going into these coves and these marinas and seeing these boatyards and doing these different races and stuff. I joined the CBYRA, which is Chesapeake Bay Yacht Racing Association. And then I raced on maxis and big monohulls. And then I graduated to multi-hulls, where I got to race on catamarans and trimarans, both beach cats and larger one performance ones. And won a couple of championships doing that and set some records doing that. And then that led me to branch out to the ocean. And I got to race offshore and do the Naples to Bermuda and Naples to Newport and Key West. And you start doing these races and stuff. And then you say, okay, well, where can I go from there? And then you start going across the oceans, across the Atlantic, and then you end up in Spain and England. And so it's just snowballed from 9 years old all the way through.
I mean, that's amazing to get that almost maybe a bit of a chance meeting with this particular schooner, with the captain of the boat who answered all your questions. I can imagine, you know, any 9-year-old just full of wonder at this huge boat and what this can go around the world. That's amazing. And it sounds like that really captured you. And I guess, you know, you spoke about how your family might not have expected you to do that. I know you actually come from a family of there's a lot of sporting success, high level success, right? Tell me a bit about that.
Yeah. So whether it's popular to say or not, but I'm the least, or at least I was the least athletic person in my family. So my father was a pretty good basketball player. My mother, the track and field growing up. And my sister was an All-American track and field runner. My brother was across all county. My younger brother was football and soccer and basketball. And, you know, I tried all those sports and I was halfway decent at basketball, but I'm only 5'10", 5'9". And as you keep going up the ranks, your height becomes more and more a factor unless you're super, super good. And so sailing gave me the opportunity to use my athletic ability that I had and my mental acumen and be able to put them together. Mm. And so I was able to go out in the water and use my, let's say, 50% good basketball athletic ability and apply that to a team of people on the boat. Because when you're on a team of people on the boat, you know, your athletic ability is not as important because you have so many people helping you out. But one of the cool things as I got older was I became an even better athlete. I started to eat better and train better. And then I got about 20 years old. I was a pretty good athlete. and then at that point, my siblings were all retiring from college or done with their sports. So then I became the pro athlete of the family. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yes. And this is a career that's going to go on and on, because I guess I look at the sailors of note that I know, and you know, some reach their peak literally in their, I don't know, 50s and 60s when they're doing some certain types of races. And we're going to come on to just some of your ambitions around sailing around the world and some of the places you're going to go in a bit. I just wanted to, I guess, touch on this whole, the access that you had to sailing, because, you know, I've seen some of the stats. Some of these are more UK stats actually, but we'll check where they're relevant for the US as well. But in terms of people from ethnic backgrounds involved in sailing in the UK, it's like less than 4%. It's a tiny amount. So there's a real diversity and inclusion issue, one might say, in sailing. So how has that, I don't know, hindered you or helped you in your journey we're getting into and on with sailing?
So the UK and the US were cousins, and so our stats are about as bad as the UK's are. One of the things I've done over the recent time is join U.S. Sailing's Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Committee with the goal of developing minority talent in the sport. And we've made some inroads, and U.S. Sailing is definitely dedicated to making it happen, because one of the things I said to them years ago, maybe a decade ago, was part of the reason why we're struggling in Olympic competition is because our best athletes aren't competing. And if you want your best athletes to compete, you have to have opportunity for everyone to try out. And a fun fact for you is that even with my exposure at a young age, at 9 years old, I didn't learn about college sailing or Olympic sailing until I was already in college. And so had I known that there was an opportunity to compete in the Olympics for sailing at a young age, I would definitely have been competing for Olympics. And so just that lack of knowledge and opportunity, the U.S. lost one of its probably best Olympians, who I would have been. I'm pretty confident in that respect. And so the goal is to make sure it doesn't happen again, next generation. And so some of the work I'm doing with U.S. Sailing and the National Sailing Hall of Fame and these other sailing clubs around the country is, hey, just get the kids on the water. Give them a chance, see what happens. And who knows, if you get 1,000 students out there, maybe 5 will pick it up, 2 may become lifetime cruisers, and 3 may race in clubs. But you don't know who their kids are going to be. Mm-hmm. And so in 2075, their daughter may become an Olympian. But if you don't give people opportunity and let them grow, that's what happens. And so I also tell people all the time, sailing is a niche sport. There is a small pocket of people who love the racing aspect and a small pocket who loves the cruising aspect. But if you don't expand your market, if you don't expand who you're selling boats to, the sport dies off. And I love the sport. I don't want to be the last African-American to do the things I do. And so the goal has to be, how can we get more people into it? And how can we keep them actively involved as they grow as people, as adults? And so it's a challenge as with any sport like this, but I'm happy to say, I know the Royal Yacht Association, they're putting in a lot of work as well. And yeah. U.S. Sailing's putting a lot of work in. And so I would envision that in the next 4 to 8 years, maybe it was 2021, so maybe 2024's Olympics and 2028's Olympics, you'll probably see some more diversity on these teams.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess if we look to other sports that have been, more dominated by white people, I'm thinking about golf, I'm thinking about tennis. Thinking about what Tiger Woods has done, what the Williams sisters have done. Just to show that, yes, this is a sport for you. You can come and do this.
Yeah, so great examples. I'm also going to toss Lewis Hamilton in there because he's one of my favorite guys. I love Lewis. I haven't met him yet, but inspires me quite a bit. Serena and Venus are the easiest two to go with, because if you look at U.S. tennis, I cannot name a single male U.S. tennis player right now. Black, white, I have no idea who they are. But if you look at the women tennis players right now, actively, there's like 7 of them in the top 50. And I think of the 7, 6 of them are African-Americans. And they all were inspired by Venus and Serena, of course. And so you look at the effect that those two women had, Venus and Serena Williams had on tennis in the States. And then, of course, globally as well, they produced a new generation of great tennis players behind them. And I'm not saying that they're going to be as good as Serena or Venus. Maybe Naomi probably is going to be the kind of like Kobe Bryant to Michael Jordan type of thing for Serena. But beyond that, I mean, some of these other girls are pretty good. And so if you remove Venus and Serena, where's U.S. tennis right now? How bad would we really be right now without having these young ladies come through? And then you look at Tiger with golf, he wasn't as active as Serena and Venus were in philanthropy when it comes to the sport, but his inspiration has led a lot of minorities to play golf at municipal courses around the country. And so membership of these courses have gone up probably with minorities simply because they saw Tiger out there doing what he was doing. And so sailing is kind of the same way. If kids don't know there's an opportunity, they're not going to pursue it. That's, I mean, I didn't know about Olympic sailing. So if someone came to me and said, hey, you could be an Olympian at a young age. You know, that would have been a life-changing moment for me. And so it's one of those things where representation inspires others to follow the path. And so one of my jobs is to make sure that I'm out there, I'm speaking about it, I'm teaching, I'm helping others so that some kid will see me and say, I want to outdo everything that Captain Lawson did.
Yeah, fabulous. So you're, you know, you've got your own personal ambitions, and that's what we're going to come to next, talk about what you want to achieve. But it sounds like you also have this dual ambition of you're setting a bar here saying, you know, come on, come and beat me. Come and get involved. Exactly. See me doing what I'm doing. And you're doing a great job of being as visible, representing, being as out there as you possibly can. And that will, as you've rightly said from these other sports, this is going to bring more people into the sport of sailing.
Yes. And the key is that, you know, I mentioned Lewis over at Mercedes. And if you think about it from the standpoint, he is the first Black driver in Formula One's history. And I think 71 years now. Just starting the season next week. Yet he's the most successful, tied with Schumacher right now at 7 chips. Some kid is watching. And I'm not saying that the kid's going to pass Lewis or Michael or Alfonso or someone. But at the end of the day, they're going to try because they see him. And so that's going to bode well for Formula One longevity. Because if you have all these kids, like Perez from Mexico, you know, these guys, they're from these countries. These kids are seeing them. And so if you have a pipeline of talent coming through, the sport survives. And so if a young lady sees me doing what I'm doing and she's like, I can do better. I'm not saying she can or she can't, but she's going to try. And the effort of trying helps the sport survive.
Yeah.
If no one cared about basketball, the NBA would be gone. So it's all about, you know, inspiring the next generation to keep pushing where you left off from.
Yeah. And just in that, and you talk about, you know, US Sailing has been very supportive of late and you're involved in the committees. But have you experienced anything that's kind of, I know you're a very determined person, but anything that's nearly put you off? Have there been kind of barriers? I mean, discrimination? What's come your way?
Yeah, I'll give you 2 great examples of that. And I tend not to give too much information, but if people are listening, they can probably figure it out. But there are yacht clubs all over the East Coast that have traditionally been Anglo-Saxon men only. That means no women. It means no minorities. And some of the traditional races have been held to these locations. And when you go there just to be a fan, sometimes just to say a fan, people were always mistaking you kind of as, well, I've been mistaken before. I might as well just say I was mistaken one time as a butler at a yacht club. And I didn't hold it against the person because the person, now that I know the person a little better over the last 16 years, not a big deal. But, you know, I see why. Because if you are a kid and you're growing up, you're a young white kid, you're growing up, your dad's a yachtsman, you're a yachtsman, and you're at the same club and all you see is what you see, it doesn't mean that you're a racist person. You just know, it's just what you see, what you know. But once you know, once you meet people, you have a chance to make a decision. And this guy's become a good friend of mine. So no big deal. But it's one of those things where we're all products of the system we kind of grew up in. And the second story being, I was fortunate to get mentors. And when you think about it, in the sport of sailing, my mentors are all be white guys because that's what I kind of grew up with.
Yeah.
And so these men took me under their wing and they taught me and they showed me and they gave me chances to make mistakes. And so the mistakes I learned from them, and if it wasn't for them, I wouldn't be the sailor I am today. And so I always bring up one of our greatest sailors, Bruce Schwab. He was the first American to finish the Vendée Globe. He finished in 9th place. The guy built his own boat out of wood.
Wow.
He entered the Vendée Globe in, I think it was in 2004. He finished in 9th place at like 30 boats. And he didn't have a title sponsor. He didn't have tons of backing. He didn't have, you know, a yacht club supporting him. It was just him, his loyal members, who donated to this foundation, and he got it done. And this guy took me in right after the Vendée and mentored me, and I sailed with him, and he taught me, and he took me places around the country and stuff. And that experience, what it did for me, it built my confidence. Because when the top American offshore sailor says to you, you're doing a good job, that means something, you know? Mm. And so that mentally got me going more. And then he's the reason why I also got into records, because he said to me, one of our passages, he said, hey, you know, I'm not sure what the record for this course is that we just did, but we probably just set the world record. And that's where I said, you know what? That's the direction I want to go. I know I've been doing racing. I enjoy racing. Racing is fun. But I've done more passages in my life than I've done races now, because going to different destinations, that's the thing for me. So, but we'll get to that later.
Well, no, I mean, it sets it up really nicely in that, and thanks for sharing that. There's an element of, okay, here's the some of the prejudices that you've experienced, but also some of the incredible, like you say, mentorship, the support that's come your way as well. And that's, I'm sure, that's you know, formed who you are, and as I said before, what you want to do and how you want to play it back to various communities. As you say, it's about encouraging as many people as possible to get in a boat and try it out, because it could just be their thing.
It could be, you know. Sailing, I also taught for a number of years. I taught for about 17 years all over the world. When I taught the Naval Academy in Annapolis, I used to tell the midshipmen that sailing is a teacher of life. I said, you guys are about to graduate, guys and girls are about to graduate and serve on nuclear subs, command aircraft carriers. There's no sails in those books, okay? But what you're going to learn here is how to command a boat, how to lead a team, how to navigate. And from there, it's going to help shape your personality, shape who you're, the person you want to be. And so the integrity, the courage you need to do the job will then translate to your profession on a nuclear sub. And I always look at sailing as my goal is not to produce world-class sailors. If it happens, it happens. My goal is to develop the people who can sail. Who just happen to be pretty good sailors. And so one of the projects I worked on, helped start, was a program where we started bringing in inner city kids, and they had no experience on the water, and we take them out in the boat for a summer, teach them how to sail, and then the following year, if they graduate, they can come back as paid instructors at sailing school. And some of these students have gone on to become Marines and Naval architects and boat captains and tugboat people, and they wouldn't have had those opportunities had they not been through our program. And so again, the goal is to make them the best people they can be. And also they may be able to sail as well.
Yeah, I love that, you know, the sailing is a teacher for life, and this confidence, this belief in yourself that it can give you. And as you say, you may not end up skippering an America's Cup boat, but look at all these other amazing professions and hobbies and passions that people have got because they had the opportunity to get in that boat with you.
I love seeing the stories of my students, or former employees and stuff, when they go off. And I remember one young lady was running a sailing center, and when she first started, she was one of my students. So it was just really cool. It's just, I love seeing it. So it's proof that the process is working. And so the goal for me is just to keep enhancing it and helping more people with it.
Yeah.
Again, you never know how life-changing an experience could be for a 9-year-old kid like it was for me.
Well, there we go. And that's the experience that, you know, you as a 9-year-old have. So let's talk about that now, in terms of, we've talked about, you know, the visibility of what you're doing, and we're going to, let's take it up a notch, because we're going to talk about some of the records that you've got in mind, some of the adventures you're going to have. And there's some incredible stuff in here, some you know, highly courageous things that you've got on the agenda. So just talk us through some of the things that are coming up for you, Donald.
So if we go back to when I was 9, and the captain of that boat told me I could sail the boat around the world, the complete sentence was, you could sail the boat around the world by yourself. It's a complete sentence he said to me. And so at that stage, I had no idea solo sailing existed. And so I'm going to give a year to this story now. It's 1988. And so when you think about that, the Vendée Globe was hadn't happened yet. I think the first one was in 1992. That's a solo nonstop around the world race.
Yeah.
There was a race called the Golden Globe in 68. Sir Robert Knox Johnson won.
Yes.
In between those, there was what's called the Round Alone, which is it doesn't exist race anymore, but it was a race where you would sail from ports to ports around the world. At that time, when he said that to me, I think maybe five people had sailed around the world solo, nonstop at that stage. By today's standard now, and it's probably a couple hundred, because that race, Vaughan de Globe, happens every 4 years, and you get about 30 boats. There's some repeat skippers, some new skippers. And since then, civilians now, with technology we have, are able to go around the world by themselves as well on a regular sailboat. But at the time, he told me that wasn't a thing. So what happened for me was my mother bought me some National Geographic magazines. And inside of one of the magazines, there was a world map. And so I put it on the wall in my bedroom. And as I'm looking at the map, I'm tracing my route around the world from Baltimore. And then I noticed on the map, there was these brownish orange dotted lines between cities like New York to Plymouth. And that's where I learned about the trade routes, the routes that were used for records and in commerce. And so from that point on, I started doing trips and voyages. I got to hop on boats as a crew member, and I would just be a deckhand, and I work my way up to navigator and skippers and boats. And what happened, basically in a nutshell, was I realized there's a profession in breaking records. And it's something that I didn't even know. And I mean, how do you know if you don't know? And so what happened was I started watching, and there was a guy named Francis Joyon. He's a Frenchman. And he had this trimaran, and he went around the world. He got around, I think, in 72 days. And then a woman named Ellen MacArthur, now Dame,
yes. Yeah.
I got to meet her in 2002. And that's when she started her multi-haul around the world stuff. She went around the world and broke Francis' record and took it down to 71 days. Francis gets upset, comes back, builds a new boat, takes it down to, I think, 65 days or 62 days. And then the race is on. And now everyone's building these giant trimarans, these boats, to break the world record. As the competition gets tighter and tighter and tighter, it gets more and more expensive. So I think Bink Popolaire is building a boat right now. It's going to be launched in about a week or two for Armel Le Clash. It's a 125-foot trimaran. It probably costs $20 million to build.
Wow.
Yeah, and so that's not practical for the average person to do, right? So what you have, the governing body, they have categories for boats for 60 feet or bigger, which is called the unlimited class. You have 49 feet to 60 feet, that's class B. And you have 49 down to 24 feet, that's class C. Most boats on the ocean fall into class B. That's your open 60s, that's your Orma 60, trimarans, your open 50 boats. And so I will be competing in the class B category for a number of world records and eventually competing in the 2024 Vaughan de Globe. And so I will be the first African-American to compete in the Vaughan de Globe in 2024. Only the fourth American to compete in the Vaughan de Globe. And my goal is to break Rich Wilson's American record of 107 days and try to get that down to a more competitive level.
Yeah.
Because the American record Rich set a couple of editions ago, 107 days, I think the last place boat that just finished about a month ago finished in 110 days. So that's how far behind the Americans are in that event.
Right.
And so the world record is 174 days, I believe, by Armel. And so I believe we can cut a 40-day deficit down. We'll just be more respectful to the rest of the world.
So the current Vaughan de record was at 74 days, is the
about 74, yeah, I think 74, right. 73, yeah.
Yeah. So that current American record doesn't look terribly competitive for a very large country surrounded by oceans. Sailing should be part of America's Cup. It's called the America's Cup because the Americans were so successful at winning that particular trophy so frequently, right? So,
the boat America won it, so that's why they named it the America's Cup. But that's, it's one of those things where in the States, again, people still think that sailing is a rich man's sport. You see this yachting. It's very rare you actually hear it called sailing in the States. Mm. We call it yachting. And it's not yachting. Okay. Most sailors live paycheck to paycheck or project to project. We've been called, I'm not gonna say all the nicknames we called ourselves, but mercenaries is one of the words we use, where there's a wealthy person who owns a boat, who needs a crew to race the boat. They hire you to do the job and they send you home. That's how the majority of us work, make a living. And so it's not a situation where we're all sailing around drinking martinis and, you know, bathing suits, having a good time. It's hard work. But what happens a lot of times is perception. If the media sees it a certain way or the public sees it a certain way, then that's how it's going to be accepted. So part of my job and others is to bring reality to the story, if you will, and show what it's really like and how difficult it is. And so when it comes to these records and these times we've posted as Americans, I personally found it embarrassing because I have friends in France, I have friends in UK, New Zealand, Australia, who are probably listening to this right now, and they're laughing because they know I tell them all the time, you know, we're better than that. We're better than 40 days behind a world record. And so, you know, at the end of the day, if we don't put the effort in, our record will become, you know, a second class record.
Yeah.
And we don't. And so for me, I won't allow that to happen. I'm already planning two trips around the world for that record, American record, over the next 4 years. So, because sometimes you may start and something happens, you got to restart over again. So I'm like, hey, we're going to do it twice, bare minimum. And we're going to try to bring that down to a respectable number. And if we get the funding in place for 2024, I don't see why we don't go for the world record and take and break Armel's record. So, that's where we are.
Wow. I just love that vision, the determination, the ambition that's in that. And you use the word effort, and I want to kind of get into, paint a bit of a picture of what you are expecting. Because I, you know, before we spoke, and I was following the Vendée Globe this year, because I'm, you know, I'm a bit of an armchair sailing fan myself. Looking at the route of the Vendée Globe, the race, and just some of the places that you go in terms of, you know, South Atlantic, Cape of Good Hope, Cape Horn, sort of south of Australia and New Zealand, sort of just north of the Antarctic. I mean, this is the most inhospitable places on the earth, I would have thought. I mean, more people have probably summited Everest than done what you're intending to do. So just tell us a bit about that, what life is like when you're in that kind of environment.
The ocean is, besides the pollution we've done to the ocean itself is the most primitive place on earth we have, because the ocean has never changed. It's exactly how it was a million years ago. And certain parts of the world have been inhospitable forever. And so the Arctic Ocean, we call it the Southern Ocean, between Cape Hope of Africa, all the way around to Cape Horn of Chile in South America, that's not a place that a lot of people go. If you're down there and something goes wrong, the chances of you being rescued by a passing ship is like winning the lottery, because no one goes down there. There's no reason for a cargo ship or a warship to be down there. If you're going to trade commerce from China to Europe, you're going to do the Panama Canal or Suez Canal. You're not going down to Cape Horn. And so the reality is that once you cross the Cape of Good Hope under South Africa, you're pretty much on your own. And depending on how fast your boat is and the weather systems, you could be down there for a month and a half. And so there's been times where people have dismasted it or lost a keel, or in some people's cases, flipped the boat over. And the only person that can rescue them is if you're doing a race like the Vendée, is another crew member.
Yes.
And so I'm sure you saw back in late November when PRB, Kevin Scofier's boat snapped in half, and he had like 15 seconds to get a survival suit on and get off the boat before it sunk. And he got into the life raft and the only person who could save him was John McCam. And John McCam managed to find him the next morning and rescue him with his boat.
And this is a competitor, isn't it? This is someone you're sailing against, that said you're racing against. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And so part of the rules of the sea is that you have to give assistance to another boat in distress, no matter where you are in the world. That's a requirement by international law. Mm. Now, during the Vendée and these kind of races, there is a camaraderie where we understand we need each other to get home safely. We all have families, some people have kids, and you don't want to win a race and then say, well, I won the race, but I did let that guy die to win this race.
Yeah.
And so when it came down to, John McCam was able to rescue him. And the irony is John McCam was once rescued during the same race back in 2008 when his boat capsized. And the same sponsor, PRB, with different skipper, pulled him out of the ocean. And wow. So how the circles turn, right?
Yeah.
But it's one of those things where when you're down there, you know, the waves, I mean, people hear these numbers, but they can't picture it. So I always do this. Just picture a power line in your front yard or on the street, you're driving down the street, a wave twice as high at the power line. Okay. Those are how the waves get. And closer to land you are, or the bigger the currents, the bigger the waves can be. So I have physically sailed through waves in the Gulf Stream in particular, on North Atlantic, they were the size of stadiums. Oh. And I'm having to surf these waves manually because I can't trust the pilot to do it, all these waves. So imagine doing that for a month and a half by yourself, and then add into the factor that you're freezing cold, you're down in Antarctica, you're soaking wet, you can't sleep a lot because the boat's just rushing along and you have to constantly adjust the boat and the sails. And then you're already tired because it took you a month and a half just to get there. So the boat's tired, you're tired, you got to deal with this. And then you have to pop back up the Atlantic to get home. And so what it comes down to, only the best men and women do this stuff. This is why, you know, I have a lot of respect for the other facets of sailing, inland racing like the America's Cup and crew racing like the Volvo Ocean Race. They're very difficult events, but it takes a special individual to do this kind of work. And so now I'm gonna hype this up even more. So that's the Vendée Globe, that's the race. People like me also go by ourselves without a race. Most records, 99% of the records are done, you take your boat and you go. And there's no one with you.
Right.
And so then imagine now, here I am in the South Pacific. There's this place in the South Pacific called Nemo Point Nemo, where that's the furthest from land on the entire planet. And you have to pass that spot. And the closest people to you are people in the space station above your head, 275 miles above your head. And so if I get in trouble, let's say in the Indian Ocean, I'm on my own. There's no one to come and get me out there. And so when people cast off and do these records, I mentioned Elle MacArthur, Dame Elle MacArthur, when she went out there and did her record, you know, she had a generator issue and she was approaching South Africa. Well, she's on her own. So she had to fix the boat while still doing the record. And there's no one who can help her. And so when it comes down to sailing around the world, you know, you have your race, the Vendée, which is strictly competitive Formula One hardcore racing on the ocean. And then you have the record breakers. And the current outright record holder for the fastest circumnavigation nonstop is Francis Gabar. He was on board his trimaran, Massif, which is a 100-foot trimaran. And he got around in 45 days. That's only 3 days behind the world record for a crew, which is 42 days. So just picture that, if you will, in your head. This guy by himself, on a boat the same size as a crew, got around 3 days behind them. But if he had any issues, he would have died out there because that boat is 100 feet long.
And I'm really pleased we got into this area because it seems to touch on mojo quite a lot.
Yes.
What is it about that being by yourself, doing it by yourself, only having yourself really to rely on? I appreciate another boat might come and rescue, but essentially to fix everything on the boat, to make all the decisions on the boat. What does that say about you, do you think?
Yeah. So let's go back to the mojo word first, because that's the key to all this. And so I know it sounds cliche because we're on the Mojo podcast, but no, that's actually real. The psychological aspect of this is you have to be your self-motivator. Mm. You have to be your own coach. There's no outside system. I forgot to mention that part. There's no coach. Okay. There's no weather route. It's you. And so your ability to keep yourself in a mental place where no matter what problem comes, I will solve it. No matter what happens, I can't get too high or too low. You have to have an even mentality where if I fail, I don't come home. That's what it comes down to. Mm. So the mojo, and we talk about this a lot, is that I have an ability to focus and lock in that I find is very unique to certain people I meet or I may see on TV. And so I will watch athletes in other sports or my sport in other sports as they're competing. And I can see and sense where their mind starts to drift. And what happens a lot of times is that when you're watching a sailboat race like the Vendée, if you watch a tracker and you watch where the boat's going and how it's moving, you get a sense of that sailor struggling with a repair, struggling probably mentally. If they're sleeping, you can see how the boat's performing, how it's moving. And it's really difficult to stay focused for 80 days nonstop. It's difficult. It's hard. Today, we have WhatsApp and these satellite systems. We can talk to our family and friends. But just imagine back in 1992 or 2000, they're going around the world. The internet was basically new. There was no cell phones. There's no laptops, really. Now, you're trying to do all this on your own. And so one of the difficult parts is the psychological aspect. So you have to have the ability to make yourself happy, whether it's through music, which I need music. So that's one of my things that I do. I have certain playlists. And so I have my Happy Mojo playlist where I listen to certain songs. And some of the songs are some girly songs. No, maybe some Beyonce or somebody. I play it because it makes me happy.
Yeah.
And it may seem silly on land. You may walk around singing Single Ladies, but on the boat when you're by yourself, you know, that gives you some happy energy. And so everything's it's all psychological, because I don't care how strong you are, how experienced you are. You mentioned a good point. A lot of people, a lot of sailors hit the stride in their 40s and 50s when it comes to sailing, because you have to have that maturity to be able to control yourself and control your craft while you're doing it. So, yeah.
Here's the thing, I suppose, Donald, is that, you know, we've talked about just how dangerous the territory that you'll be going into is, whether it's the world, or like around the world record, or it's the Vendée Globe, it all kind of goes in the same direction south. Yeah. What happens when things you don't expect to happen happen?
Yes.
What happens?
So, then? Life. I call that life, you know? So you can't mitigate risk to the point where the boat can survive a tank round or a nuclear detonation. It's just because the boat will be too slow. So what you have to do, you have to have the fastest boat possible, the best technology you can have that assists you get the job done. If I'm out there and I'm sailing along and I hit a whale and the race stops, it's not my fault. The whale and I just happen to be on a path in life where we met. And that's what happens. It's disappointing. It's sad. I hope the whale survives. I hope I survive. But, you know, it happens. But there's been enough people who have been successful at these passages where you can study their routes, where they went and where they did not go. So I'll give you a great example to answer this question. In the last Vendée Globe, I think the attrition rate was the lowest in the race history. 33 boats started, 25 boats finished. Mm. That's astonishing. I mean, the weather being very mild was part of the factor. The boats didn't push as hard as they normally do. But a lot of the boats that didn't make it all failed at the same location in the South Atlantic. In between St. Helena High and Cape of Hope, Good Hope, that little area right there. Mm. And I took some time and I went back and reviewed it over and over again. I'm like, this can't be a coincidence. It had to be some kind of factor in play. and this is not scientific. I'm not saying that this is everyone should follow this. But what I got from it, I studied not just the weather maps, I studied the currents as well. And what a lot of people don't know is that even though you're going west to east as you pass Good Hope with the weather's pushing you along, there's a current right under Cape Town that's coming the opposite direction between Madagascar and Africa, South Africa. That current kicks up big waves. Those are the waves that broke PRB, Kevin Scofield's boat, in half.
Right.
He's going head into those currents while the wind's pushing him. So if you're slamming into waves with the wind pushing you, you're going to break the boat.
Yeah.
That's the first thing. The second thing, other boats in the area hit a lot of trash and debris and damaged your boats. So you think about it, you look at where they hit debris and stuff, all of them were fighting that current. So the lesson for me is when I pass that point in the map, to go far enough south where the current's going with me and the wind's going with me to try to mitigate the possibility of slamming into waves and hitting debris coming from the opposite side of Africa. So those are the kind of things that when you study your craft, you learn these little bits and pieces that maybe it helps, maybe it doesn't help. But if you make decisions, wise decisions, you can not have to find out if you're right or wrong. You just kind of get by.
What's the next step in terms of, because you know we touched on some of the financial aspect of this sport of sailing. These boats cost a lot of money. What's in the mix for you in terms of getting a boat, getting sponsors? What needs to happen?
So we have a boat. It's a 60-foot Imoca. It's a 2008 vintage, but it's a super strong, super durable boat. And so for the record around, the goal is to have a durable boat because, again, things happen. I'm sure we may collide with different things, but you want to complete the voyage. The voyage itself, completion, is a victory. And by completing, I'm sure I will break the American record at that stage. Maybe not the world record, but at least the American record. We're in the process right now of talking to a number of companies about joining the project, because there's been an appetite for companies to show they're into diversity and inclusion, mm-hmm. to show that they care about being part of things like this. And so we're like, well, we're here. This is what we're doing. This is what we've done. This is your opportunity to be part of history. Because if you think about it from the standpoint, Tiger is, I'm sure, like 45 years old by now. So he's on the tail end of his professional career. Serena is on the tail end of her career. Lewis probably got another 2-3 years of interest and Formula One left. No, we're kind of the next thing. We're the opportunity. If you want to be a part of something that's going to matter, this is your chance to be a part of it. And so one of the important things that I did was I joined forces with a organization that has over 20 years experience doing this kind of work, because only a fool would think he can race around the world and manage sponsorships at the same time. That's nuts. So you got to have the best people that you could possibly have with experience help you make it happen. Simon Clay and the guys at Whitecap agreed to partner and run my programs.
Yeah.
And because of those guys, I'm now able to focus on my sailing while they're handling all the commercial side and stuff in the background. And Simon and those guys have done an incredible job. I mean, my wife and I talk about it all the time, that there's no way in the world that we would be in some of these boardrooms and talking to some of these companies if it wasn't for him and his team. And so from that aspect of it, we are looking at a departure next fall for my round the world record. We're using this year for some Imoca racing and stuff to prep myself with the boat and team ready. And then beginning of next year, I do some smaller records as warm-ups, and then do the big record next November. And then in 2024, come back and do the Vendée Globe itself. So having Simon and his team, we have some of the best boat builders, some of the best navigation people, some of the best education people working with us. Because part of our goal is to share the story as an educational platform through science, technology, clean energy initiatives we're doing, and that kind of stuff.
Amazing. Amazing. And that's what everybody needs, to have the team around you so you can dedicate yourself to what it is you do brilliantly right. well, which is sail a boat very fast and right. safely.
And safely. For me, could you imagine Lewis having to build his own car just to race?
Exactly. Or going and finding the sponsors by himself. No, exactly. Right. You need these people. You need these people around you.
Yes.
Fantastic. Donald, I always sort of start to close the chat just around, you know, back to Mojo again. And we've talked about that the whole way through. And you mentioned something. I know music's important to you when you're, you're sailing, not sailing, but anything else that you know I've got to have around me, apart from being on a boat with a drink, which you mentioned right up front, other things that you need to keep that wonderful mojo you've got. And boy, have you got it. I can just tell. I can know it's a 9.5. Maybe it's a 10. What other things that you do quite regularly to keep your mojo high?
Yeah, so a lot. Mental health is like, it's a new phrase now, but I'm not active in the church, but I grew up in the church. Hmm. And so one of the things my father, who's a minister, always talk about is about having a song in your heart. And so if a person sees me, let's say someone listening today, they see me one day at the yacht club, say hi first, of course, but ask me, what song are you thinking about right now? And I'll tell you what song is in my head. So right now, song in my head right now is actually Sugar by Maroon 5. it's my head. So it's playing over and over again. Yeah. And so for me, every time I'm doing something, I'm washing dishes or fixing cars or whatever I'm fixing, there's a song always playing because my life moves to a rhythm. And I've learned that when I have a rhythm in my head, I'm able to process information better. And so when I'm out there sailing, it's the same thing. There was times where I'm not really big on country music, but I've had a country song at one point in time playing in my head a couple of years ago when I was racing outside. And then people were like, are you humming? So I'm like, yeah. Like, how do you know that song? But that's one thing. So my mojo, my spirit, music support. Next thing for me, my passages, is I have on my cell phone, literally, and this is going to sound crazy, but hear me out, guys. I have over 3,000 pictures of my wife in my phone. Now, I'm not crazy. Well, maybe a little bit. She's my high school sweetheart. Okay, so we've been together since the early 90s. And so she is a big part of my psyche. And we're always together. I mean, when I'm not sailing or traveling, you will never see us separate from each other. We're like two squirrels running around a tree together. And so for me, when I'm going on these passages, I will have a slideshow on my computers of just pictures of her sliding by. And what happens a lot of times, I'll tell you a little secret. It's a little secret. I haven't told anyone in the media before, but I have a philosophy that no matter what I do, where I go, I'm always coming home. So there's no, you know, ambiguity in that statement. It's simple. Mm. I will go out and do my job, but I'm also coming home. Mm. And so because my responsibility is not just to myself, but it's to her. And so when I'm out there competing and I'm doing my thing, there's times where I'll call her. And I've called her in tears sometimes because things are hard and difficult, and she'll give me encouragement. And she's because she can track me on her phone or the computer. She sees where I'm at. She knows what's going on. I'll do a weather brief for her, let her know, hey, in 24 hours, the wind's shifting. And I'll bore her to death with it. You know, she does sail, but I will bore her to death because I talk a lot about sailing. But she keeps me going.
Yeah.
And there's other times where, let's say, maybe I don't need as much love. I need some grit. Mm. I'll call my father.
Yeah.
Who I mentioned was a minister.
Yeah.
And he will set me straight. Or if my dad's not available, my mother was equally, we call her the general. She will equally keep me straight. And so, you know, I have people in my life. My network is very much about helping each other. So if we're friends, we talk, we hold each other accountable for our dreams and our goals. And if I'm in the game and I'm playing and I'm executing my race, and I get discouraged, I know who to call, who to talk to give me what I need to keep going. Mm. And so for those listening, understanding your mojo is your energy that you have, but it's what you feed yourself with. And the people around you is the majority of the energy you're going to receive. You show me your friends, I will tell you what kind of person you really are. And that's kind of how I operate.
I love that. I love that. I've just released an episode about radiators. We talk about those sorts of people are radiators versus drains, people that draw your energy, people that give you energy. It's exactly that. It's exactly that. Well, Donald, I have just loved that conversation, really. Thank you for taking the time. I know there's loads going on right now, and there's some announcements coming up about supporters and sponsors, hopefully which will have happened just before this episode drops. But I just wanted to thank you for taking the time, and I wish you all the best. I'm not going to say luck. I just wish you all the best with everything you're looking to do, because I just know you're going to achieve it all.
Wait, Richard, I really appreciate it. You've been awesome to talk to. This is our couple, we've actually talked a couple of times, and your energy is so great. It motivates me to talk more. So hopefully I answered all the questions. Hopefully you're happy with what you hear. Hopefully your listeners are inspired by the conversation. And just a little plug, if you guys want to follow what we're doing here, we have a Facebook page under Captain Don Lawson, Instagram page under the same name, Captain Don Lawson. Feel free to send me a message. I do respond back to every message I get. And there's no stupid questions. And if you're interested in learning about sailing, I will tell you where to go in your region to find out where to start.
Donald, that's amazing. And I'll make sure all those links are in the show notes as well, so people can follow you and ask you some great questions about sailing. We wish you all the best. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard. And you have a great day. Enjoy that wonderful weather in the Mediterranean. Oh, I'm so jealous.
What a great conversation. Donald and I chatted for about another hour after this. Such a lovely, generous and inspiring guy. Can't wait to meet him actually in the flesh and ideally go sailing with him one day. Before any summary from me on this episode, I want to encourage you to follow Captain Lawson on social media, so you can keep up to date with developments in his quest. So check out the show notes for details of his Instagram and Facebook, and do drop him a line as he invites you to. Any questions about sailing, he will answer them. That's just the generosity in him, and he's always, always giving. Now, there's a profound circular route to Donald's mojo, I believe. I think it goes something like this. He dreams big, as he did as that 9-year-old boy on that schooner that day when he worked out it could go all the way around the world. He then develops the belief that he can succeed, and this is based on the skill and experience he's developed and created throughout his life. You know, he's done the hard yards in terms of understanding the sea, navigation, weather, everything. And then he does it. He gets out there. He has sailed the miles and he's learned the lessons. As he says, sailing is the greatest teacher. Then he goes again. And a new dream is born out of what he's done. And that new dream is this quest to be the first African-American to compete and do really well, actually, not just compete, in the Vendée Globe in 2024. So dream, believe, do. Just remember that for your own mojo. And go, Donald. I'll be following you all the way to Vendée Globe and beyond. I know you are, and you will be even more of an inspiration to so many people on this journey. I hope this has inspired something in you too. Let me know what's come up for you via Instagram or LinkedIn, and please do subscribe for the next episode in 2 weeks' time. It'd be great if you could leave a 5-star rating for this episode too, and it would really put the wind in my sails if you could leave a short review on Apple Podcasts, so even more people can discover stories like this one. Okay, until next time, I hope your mojo continues to flow.